Earlier this season, I did an episode about the disappearance of Jean McConville. Dolores Price claimed that she played a prominent role in the disappearance, so it seemed like the right time to do an episode on Dolores herself. Together with her sister Marion, they were two of the most infamous women in the United Kingdom and Ireland at one point during the Troubles. This is her story. This is the Troubles podcast, a podcast which explores the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain, as multiple sides and organisations waged a violent conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. Dolores Price was born in Belfast on the 16th of December 1950. Her sister Marion was born 4 years later in 1954. Her mother, Chrissy, and father, Albert, were very strongly Republican, and there was generations of paramilitary activity in her family. Dolores' mother and grandmother had both served time in prison for Republican activity. Dolores' aunt, Bridie, lived with them. Years earlier, in 1938, she was taking part in a paramilitary operation, moving explosives at an IRA arms dump when they accidentally detonated. Bridie was badly mutilated, losing her hands and eyes in the incident. For the rest of her life, she needed constant support. As a young child, Dolores used to spend hours up in Bridie's room, lighting her cigarettes and helping her to smoke them. Dolores' father, Albert, took part in the IRA's bombing campaign in Britain in 1939, after the IRA officially declared war on Britain. He spent a number of years in and out of prison for different paramilitary-related activities. Dolores believed that she and her family were different than the Catholic people who were not Republicans, saying, quote, "The Catholic population in my growing up time were very downtrodden people and very accepting of their second-class citizenship. Whereas we, as Republicans, had a kind of strange arrogance because we believed we were the possessors of the truth, the absolute truth, and how the island should be run, and we believed ourselves to be the custodians of the men of 1916, and we in many ways regarded ourselves as elite." Dolores initially applied to art college, but did not get in, and instead enrolled in St. Mary's Teacher Training College. From an early age, her and her sister were actively involved in protesting. They took part in the People's Democracy March from Belfast to Derry in 1969, which is considered to have set the scene for the upcoming Troubles. During the march at Burntollet Bridge, the marchers were attacked by unionists armed with iron bars, stones and nail-studded sticks. The Ulster Police Force, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, or RUC, were nearby and did very little to stem the flow of the violence. This would heavily damage their reputation and lead to accusations that they were a biased police force. For Dolores, the violence at this march pulled her away from the socialist leaning that she had developed in college, back to republicanism. She felt she needed to do something to stop the injustice she perceived that was occurring. Cumann na mBan, which means the Woman's Council, was the female wing of the IRA. Dolores' mother and grandmother had both been a part of it, and she was advised to do the same. Members of Cumann na mBan had more of an ancillary role, and would care for those injured while carrying out attacks, or hide weapons that had been used in attacks. Dolores didn't want a supporting role, she wanted to fight, so she joined the Provisional IRA. Dolores and Marion joined the IRA in 1971. So by day, the two sisters would attend college, then at night they would take part in whatever operation they were assigned to. She said of joining, quote, "I do not want to be rolling bandages, you know. That's not what I want to do. I want to fight. They put me in a room with a load of rusty bullets and some steel wool, and my job was to clean those bullets. That incensed me, but I did it. I obeyed all orders." Shortly after joining, she was sent across the border into the Republic of Ireland for her training. They learned how to care for and assemble guns, as well as how to set and prime explosives. Her first few jobs with the Provisional IRA was to transport explosives from the Republic of Ireland into Northern Ireland. Dolores and Marion would do so around 4 to 5 times a week, hiding the explosives in the door panels of their car. They even became friendly with some of the British soldiers who manned the checkpoints, and they knew her by her fake name as Rosie. The soldiers had no idea that the two attractive young women were smuggling explosives right under their noses. Dolores took part in a number of operations, including robbing a bank dressed as a nun, hijacking a post office van, and staging prison escapes. She was known as being quite elegant, and her and her sister quickly developed a reputation in Northern Ireland. Dolores was also a member of the incredibly secretive group known as the Unknowns, who were the special intelligence unit of the IRA who helped to disappear a number of individuals who were accused of being informers. Dolores believed that informers were, quote, the lowest form of human life. They were less than human, and death was too good for them. She also claimed that the Unknowns reported directly to Gerry Adams, though Gerry Adams has disputed this, saying that he has never been a member of the Provisional IRA. IRA members Kevin McKee and Seamus Wright were among the first few to be disappeared. Dolores and Marion had the job of picking them up and driving them across the border to their eventual deaths. Dolores claims that the two men believed that they were going on a holiday due to stress. In the documentary I, Dolores, Dolores explains that the men had fun with the local IRA unit before she said, quote, ultimately, I believe they were shot. The bodies of the two young men were not discovered until 2015. Then in 1972, Dolores claims that she took part in one of the most controversial incidents to happen in the entire Troubles, the murder of Jean McConville. I'll be brief here because it's covered in depth in an earlier episode, but Jean was a mother of 10 who was taken by the IRA and never seen again. The IRA claimed that Jean was an informer, and Dolores claimed that she was part of the group that kidnapped Jean and brought her across the border into the Republic of Ireland, where she was eventually killed. Her role in the Jean McConville case is really something that has only recently emerged in the past decade or so. But Dolores gained worldwide notoriety in 1973, when the IRA began its campaign to bomb mainland Britain. They saw how the Dublin and Monaghan bombings of 1972 were reported around the world, and believed that a bombing campaign in the UK would bring media attention to their cause and bring the issue of the Troubles back to the front of the newspapers again. The initial plan was to firebomb a number of department stores in London, but the acid in the firebombs had leaked and the operation had to be abandoned. So then a plan was put in place to plant car bombs in London instead. Dolores said of the operation, "We selected targets that were emblems of the British Empire." A team of young paramilitaries, all in their late teens and early 20s, headed over. Dolores and Marion were part of the operation, and it was Dolores herself who was selected to become the operational commander of the plan. The cars to be used were hijacked at gunpoint in Northern Ireland, then driven into the Republic of Ireland, where they were repainted and filled with a large amount of explosives. Four cars eventually made their way onto mainland Britain via the Dublin to Liverpool ferry. With their plan in motion, the team had the evening off, so Dolores and her sister went to the theatre in London. She watched a play written by Irishman Brian Friel, which featured the Northern Irish actor Stephen Ray. Unbeknownst to Dolores, she was watching her future husband perform on stage. Then, early the next morning, the bombs were planted in four areas around London. The timers on the bombs were set to go off around 3 p.m. and the team were under strict instructions to try and limit civilian casualties after the disaster that was Bloody Friday. So at 2 p.m. on the 8th of March 1973, a phone rang at the headquarters of the Times newspaper, where an Irish-accented individual listed off locations and describing cars before saying, quote, "The bombs will go off in an hour." The plan was for the team to be back in Ireland by the time the bombs had exploded in London, but it turns out that long before the warning call was placed, British police had been tipped off that there was an impending attack and were on the lookout for any suspicious cars. They found one of the bomb cars and defused it, but knew that their time was running out. Eventually, another bomb car had been identified and defused, but the other two detonated, causing massive amounts of damage, one of which was at the Old Bailey, which was the Central Criminal Court of England.
When the bomb exploded, there were bodies and PCs lying in the street. Members of the public were obviously very badly injured. I tried with others to apply pressure points and fix tourniquets to injured parts of the body. One chap I remember clearly had a very bad gash in his groin and blood was pouring out. And
policeman, was he?
Yeah, he was a policeman. And then the ambulances arrived. to take the injured away. Then an ambulance driver or attendant virtually frog marched me up to Bart's, which he was doing his job. You know, I suppose he thought, well, get up there, but I could have done with staying, really, you know.
You must have been feeling pretty shattered then.
Yes, I went a bit deaf, actually. That's the main effect was that I went deaf. You know, the noise of the blast. That's all. Am I shouting now? No.
Not really, no.
Okay.
In total, 250 people were injured by debris and broken glass, and one man, 58-year-old Frederick Milton, died of a heart attack. An autopsy revealed that the heart attack had begun prior to the explosion and meant that murder charges could not be filed. Dolores later said of the many casualties in the bombing, quote, "There were warnings phoned in, but the people had stood about, curious to see. If people ignored the warnings and stood around gawking, they were stupid. The numbers of injured came about through curiosity and stupidity." In the hours before the explosion, the IRA team were making their way back to Ireland when they were stopped in Heathrow Airport by the police. It turns out that the British police had been forewarned to look out for anyone with an Irish accent flying to Ireland. Initially, this capture was perceived as smart police work, but in later years, a special branch officer revealed that they had received a tip-off from a senior member of the IRA. All but one of the team was captured because of an informant. Dolores went on to say that the police had her and Marion's photographs from the outset, so the police were expecting them, they just weren't exactly sure where they'd be. The Price sisters were interrogated and then given their prison uniforms, which they refused to wear. I've touched on this before, but in many cases, members of the IRA and other smaller paramilitary groups refused to wear prison uniforms because they believed themselves to be prisoners of war, which was different to other regular inmates. The trial became a media circus in the UK, and Dolores and her sister were dubbed the Sisters of Terror. It went on for 10 weeks, with all the defendants remaining defiant and stating their innocence. Investigators then found a notepad on Dolores with some pages torn out. They carefully examined the notepad and were able to make out the imprint of what had been drawn on the torn out pages, a diagram of a timing device for a bomb. This evidence was damning enough, but the final nail in the coffin came with one of the bombers, Roisin McNairy. She was the only one in the group to break and tell the officers everything, betraying her co-conspirators. For her cooperation, Roisin was acquitted. She was then given a new identity and told that she would never be able to return to Northern Ireland, and she subsequently disappeared into the United Kingdom, never to be heard from again. The rest of the group were given lengthy sentences, and Dolores and Marion were sentenced to 20 years behind bars. The two immediately declared that they did not accept this sentence and that they would be going on hunger strike. They demanded to be treated as political prisoners and wanted to be moved to a prison in Northern Ireland. After sentencing, the sisters were moved to Brixton Prison in the UK, which was a high-security prison in which Dolores and Marion were the only female prisoners. Their arrival caused quite a stir with the male inmates in the prison. Along with Jerry Kelly and Hugh Feeney, who were in different prisons, they immediately began a hunger strike and refused everything except water. Days turned into weeks, and they both rapidly lost a lot of weight. The press coverage that was with them during the trial stayed, and many people in the UK and Ireland were watching to see what would happen. This was a very complex situation for the British authorities. Dolores and Marion stated that they were willing to die for their beliefs. Dolores said in a letter, quote, "Volunteers died on the streets of Belfast for our cause, and our deaths will be no different from theirs." This led to a stalemate between the British authorities and the sisters. The dilemma was, if they starved themselves to death while in British custody, then it would look very bad that it was allowed to happen. The British government also believed that if the Price sisters died while in custody, then there would be a massive retaliatory action against them by paramilitaries. On the other side, they also didn't want to give in to their demands of moving them to a prison in Northern Ireland. Eventually, after 2.5 weeks, they decided the best course of action was to force feed the sisters. Marion described what the force feeding was like, quote, "Four male prison officers tie you into a chair so tightly with sheets that you can't struggle. You clench your teeth to try and keep your mouth closed, but they push a metal spring device around your jaw and prise it open. They force a wooden clamp with a hole in the middle into your mouth. Then they insert a big rubber tube down that. They hold your head back. You can't move. They throw whatever they like into the food mixer. Orange juice, soup, or cartons of cream if they want to beef up the calories. They take jugs of this gruel from the food mixer and pour it into a funnel attached to a tube. The force feeding takes 15 minutes, but it feels like longer. You're in control of nothing. You're terrified the food will go down the wrong way, and you won't be able to let them know because you can't speak or move. You're frightened you'll choke to death. These force feedings were incredibly traumatic for the Price sisters. Some readings I came across likened the force feedings to a rape, as the person being fed had absolutely no control whatsoever. Dolores later went on to say that she never had the same relationship with food ever again after these feedings. The force feeding was becoming a bit of a media fiasco for the British government. Many members of the public saw this feeding as a form of torture. Protests took place outside the prison, and famous Irish bands such as the Dubliners also played gigs to raise money for them. Eventually, after 167 days of force feeding, the British government stopped. The Price sisters had adopted a strategy of offering maximum resistance, which meant that they did everything in their power to refuse being force-fed. They kicked, screamed, bit, tore, and did everything they could to make the force feeding as difficult as possible for the administrators. As a result of this, the doctors administrating the feeding made a judgment call that it was just too dangerous to continue with it. British Home Secretary Roy Jenkins made a public statement announcing the end of this, quote, distasteful task by saying the minimal cooperation necessary for this process was withdrawn by the sisters. In total, Dolores was on hunger strike for 208 days, and she was force-fed for around 167 of those days. After the force feeding ended, the Price sisters continued with their hunger strike and their weight began to rapidly drop. Then on June 3rd, 1975, Michael Gaughan died. Michael was an IRA member who was imprisoned in a British prison on the Isle of Wight. He had also been taking part in a hunger strike, and the British government claimed that he died from pneumonia, though his family claimed that he died as a result of complications from force feeding. This death was a stark warning to Home Secretary Roy Jenkins that time was running out for the Price sisters. He was worried that their death could spark a huge response from the IRA. Privately, he also began to wonder if he allowed them to die, would he become a target for the IRA for the rest of his life? It was for these reasons he eventually made arrangement for the repatriation of the sisters, Jerry Kelly and Hugh Feeney, back to Northern Ireland. In March 1975, Dolores and Marion Price were sent back to Northern Ireland to serve out the remainder of their sentence in Armagh Women's Prison. It was a bittersweet homecoming for the two. In February, Bridie had died from pancreatic cancer, and then 4 days after Bridie's funeral, Dolores' mother, Chrissy, also died. They were given a warm welcome by the prisoners in Armagh Prison and were seen as celebrities there. The two were granted special category status in 1975, so they didn't have to work in the prison's laundry and sewing rooms like regular inmates. As the years dragged on, Dolores also found her resolve with the IRA was fading. As a teenager, she would have done anything. She was willing to kill, and she was willing to die for the Republican cause. But as she saw the entirety of her 20s passing by behind bars, she grew more and more disillusioned. When some Republican prisoners took part in their own dirty protest, Dolores stayed away from it. Then when she saw the Provisional IRA carry out the Le Mans bombing, which killed 12 innocent civilians, it made her question her devotion to the group. She eventually resigned from the IRA and went on to call herself a freelance Republican. But though life in Armagh was definitely more relaxed than the English prison, both Dolores and Marion began to realise just how long their sentence was, and the scars from the months of force feeding would work their way to the surface once again. Here's Dolores, quote, "After the hunger strike and the force feeding and all the psychological damage that created, we didn't ever have a normal relationship with food or eating. We both ended up with very distorted notions of the function of food, which resulted in us both being anorexic and not wanting to eat." Marion was hit the hardest by anorexia. British authorities concluded that she would die if she was kept in prison. As a result, she was released in April 1980 and entered into the Royal Victoria Hospital in Belfast to get treatment for her anorexia, but she was checked out a day later. it's important to remember that anorexia wasn't really taken very seriously in the 80s as well, so some people didn't believe that it was a real illness. Her release was met with fierce anger from the British media and unionists, who believed that her anorexia was a ruse to get her out of prison more quickly. Dolores had been very close with Marion, and was lost without her in prison. She was also very surprised at how little Marion would visit her while she was in prison, though she had promised to. In 1980, Dolores swallowed a large amount of sleeping pills and had to have her stomach pumped. Around this time, she struck up a friendship with the British politician Fenner Brockway, who then began to try and convince British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher to release Dolores on compassionate grounds. Here's a snippet of a letter that Brockway wrote to Thatcher. "Dear Margaret, you may remember that 8 years ago, Dolores and Marion Price received a life sentence for being involved in a bombing outrage outside the Old Bailey. I had sought to influence them against violence in the IRA. Marion has subsequently been released on health grounds, and Dolores is left isolated in Armagh Prison. Her recent letters show me that she is deeply upset psychologically. I am quite sure that if Dolores was released, she would become active, despite the dangers, in urging her fellow Catholics to refrain from violence. I enclose a letter just received from Dolores. It illustrates her condition of mind and her convictions." Thatcher flat out refused. You have to remember that by 1980, Northern Ireland was a war zone and there had been a significant bombing campaign in London by the Provisional IRA. Many British people saw them as terrorists and would have had a hard time finding sympathy for anyone who associated with them, even though Dolores claimed to have renounced her position. Then Irish Cardinal Tomás O'Fiach visited Dolores and was shocked at her condition, describing her as, quote, "a gaunt spectre, prematurely aged and deprived of any further desire to live." The 1981 hunger strike was one of the most significant moments of the Troubles. It saw a number of IRA and INLA prisoners go on hunger strike to campaign for special category status. The first person to die was Bobby Sands, and then 9 additional prisoners died while on hunger strike. It was a very dark time for the people of Northern Ireland. 2 weeks before Bobby passed away, Thatcher quietly ordered Dolores released on medical grounds, believing that she was in imminent danger of sudden collapse and death. News of her release caused outrage amongst unionists, and Ian Paisley described it as an outrageous scandal, and he went on to say that Dolores had murder in her heart. Dolores left Northern Ireland for Dublin and went on to work as a freelance writer for a number of publications. She also left paramilitary life behind, instead campaigning for nationalist politics instead of violence. In 1983, she married actor Stephen Ray, the night before the bombs went off in the Old Bailey, and the two lived in London for a short time, as it was the best place for Stephen to find work. Thatcher wasn't happy about this, as it was against the terms of Dolores' release, which stated that she stayed in Belfast. The idea that the woman who bombed London was free to roam the streets of London and enjoy the high life of theatre was upsetting, but British authorities were reluctant to arrest her, so she remained under the watchful eye of the British Crown, though they acknowledged that she posed a very minimal threat. Dolores and Stephen had 2 children together and lived in London but also kept a home in Belfast. Then, in 1994, the IRA announced a ceasefire, and then there was the signing of the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, which brought an end to the Troubles and restored a tentative peace to Northern Ireland by introducing power sharing. This deeply angered Dolores, who viewed the power sharing as an affront to the many Republicans who had killed and had been killed for the cause. Many hardline Republicans would only accept one thing, a complete British withdrawal from Northern Ireland. So to them, the Good Friday Agreement was an admission of defeat, and Dolores blamed Sinn Féin for that. Here's the transcript of Dolores calling into an Irish radio station talking about the Good Friday Agreement. Quote, "I was on a very protracted hunger strike. I suffered forcible feeding, which was a very horrendous experience. I served 8 years in prison, and for what Sinn Féin have achieved today, I would not have missed a good breakfast. Sinn Féin cynically seemed to me to be climbing over the corpses of the people who have died since the commencement of the struggle. Volunteers did not only die. Volunteers had to kill as well, you know?" Over the next few years, Dolores remained very critical of Sinn Féin and Gerry Adams, who was the leader of Sinn Féin at the time. Dolores and Stephen divorced in 2003, as Dolores was on a path of self-destruction, suffering from alcoholism, drug addiction, and PTSD. In 2001, she was arrested in Dublin and charged with possession of stolen prescription pads and forged prescriptions. She pleaded guilty and had to pay a fine and attend Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. Then in 2009, she was arrested after she was caught trying to steal a bottle of vodka from a supermarket, though she claimed that she was confused by the self-checkout service. She eventually ended up in St. Patrick's Hospital as she was suffering from depression. Dolores also began to express her discontent in other ways. She took part in the Boston College tapes, and then in 2010, she also gave a startlingly honest interview to Belfast journalist Alison Morris. In 2011, Dolores filmed an interview that went on to become the basis for the documentary I, Dolores, of which this episode draws a lot of information from. The interview was recorded with the Irish journalist Ed Maloney, who promised that it would not be released to the public until after her death. At the time, Dolores was still in St. Patrick's Hospital. The first interview was recorded on tape in the hospital, and the second interview was recorded in a rented flat with a camera crew. In the documentary, she speaks candidly about her role during the Troubles, and in particular about the disappearance of Joe Linsky and Jean McConville. Just a reminder that this account has been disputed by some, but according to Dolores, she was present when Jean McConville was executed. She then implicated Gerry Adams as having ordered the killing of McConville. Adams was eventually arrested on these implications, but was released without charge and has continually denied being a member of the IRA. On the 24th of January 2013, Dolores was found dead in her home. She was 62 and died from a toxic effect of mixing prescribed sedatives and antidepressant medication. Just 3 days before her death, she had been drinking alcohol and had to be admitted to hospital after falling down the stairs of her home. After leaving the hospital, she continued to drink and take Valium. Her death was ruled as a misadventure. Dolores' sister Marion has had a different fate. She remained a vocal opponent of Sinn Féin, and at the age of 55, she was arrested in 2009 in connection with the real IRA murders of two British soldiers in the Massarine Army base. Marion was charged with providing a mobile phone that was used by the real IRA to claim to the media that they had carried out the attack. She received a suspended sentence for this charge, but was returned to prison after the Northern Ireland Secretary, Owen Paterson, revoked her life sentence. To explain this, she was originally released in 1980 and given a license of release. When she was alleged to have been involved in paramilitary activity, this license was revoked and she was brought back to prison. She remained in prison for 2 years, but suffered severe illness while in custody, so was released on compassionate grounds in 2013. As of April 2021, Marion is still alive. It looks like the generations of paramilitary activity will end with Dolores, as she said that her two children are not involved in any way. That's the story of Dolores Price. Thanks, and see you next time. As always, I hope you've been enjoying this season, and if you want to support the podcast, you can do so over at patreon.com/thetroublespodcast. There you'll get early access to episodes, ad-free episodes, and I'll also be posting a lot of media related to the Troubles. I'll also be posting a companion video to each episode I publish. If you'd prefer to make a once-off donation instead, you can do so over at buymeacoffee.com/troublespodcast. Another way to help is to leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. It all helps.